Hi, welcome to the Responsible Management Podcast from the School of Management at the University of Bradford. My name is David Spicer. I'm Professor of Small Business Development and Organisational Studies and the Director of Business and Community Engagement here at the School of Management. Delighted to welcome you to our third Responsible Management Podcast, where we'll be focusing on well-being. Well-being being a particularly significant issue in this day and age, particularly important in the current climate. And as part of that, we need to be thinking about responsible approaches to finance. So that kind of challenge of well-being retention is very significant for organisations today. And many organisations aren't as good at that as they should be. So joining me to talk about this, I've got two great experts. Helena Savanina is a graduate of the Bradford MBA programme, fellow of the Chartered Insurance Institute and operations director at Ebor Financial Planning. Her role focuses on continually innovating and transforming the business and how they advise individual business clients on how to build and maximise their finances. Her passion lies in business development and advising clients to align their financial resources with their goals and aspirations. So Dr. George Medin, our second contributor, recently joined Bradford University as Assistant Professor in Leadership and Management on a full-time basis. Prior to this, George has taught for many years at Bradford on modules around psychology, work, leadership and management as an associate. He's a graduate of the Doctor of Business Administration programme here at the university and has extensive industry experience. He set up half a dozen of his own businesses and been director to half a dozen more and worked in both the public and the private sector. He's also a business consultant and he's actually leading on the consultancy clinic, which is a new initiative here at the School of Management. Helena, George, delighted that you'll be able to join us and contribute to the kind of conversation today. As you know, the podcast is about responsible management, so I'd like to start there. Perhaps, Helena, if you could start for us. What does responsible management mean for you?
I think the best way for me to think about the concept is any business and any company is an ecosystem, and we all have to sort of seen examples in the world where resources are not managed properly leads to a collapse. And in my mind is thinking about all the stakeholders in the company and the employees and how we can regenerate and develop the organization and our people on this journey rather than treating them as a transaction where they get paid for the work that gets done. So it's a much broader concept, and that's how I view it.
Actually, responsible management for me is one of those diffuse statements that's about ethical, environmental impact. I actually looked it up on Wikipedia this morning. It said about meeting minimum environmental standards. That doesn't really do it justice. When you apply this responsible management to your workforce, actually it can become one of the most powerful tools in a manager's toolbox.
Great, thank you. So yeah, I'm thinking particularly about our focus today as well, which is on well-being and that kind of focus on how we support, engage and enable people within the workplace. What specific issues do businesses need to consider in this regard when they're thinking with that kind of responsible management mindset? George?
Well, in terms of the workforce, the workforce has changed dramatically over the years. And at the moment, we have a major problem. Brexit has massively reduced the number of people that's available to work. And we have this big problem at the moment with retention of staff. And with our staff at the moment, they've lived in a world where we have this idea of the young people are going to schools learning about ethics, social responsibility, and the right that they have. And if we're going to run businesses and retain our people, we have to feed this back in how we deal with them. And that's one of the big things that I work with at the moment, this retention of people in a world where ethics and social responsibility is now part of the workforce experience.
I would like to pick up on the experience as a concept, because our businesses are moving to experience economy where our employees have to stage experience for our customers. And the biggest question for me as a leader is what experiences am I going to create for my employees within the organization? And it certainly goes much beyond than just ensuring the pay package is a much broader concept in the way that is caring for mental health, being flexible and responsive to employee needs, and sort of working with evolving concepts as to what work means to people and how we conduct it and how we can carry on to continue to be a bridge between the clients and the employees, because these are two connected links and we need to ensure that it translates. If our people are not feeling cared about, there is no way our customers will be cared by the same people.
So employee engagement is a key aspect then of well-being, or the two are related from a responsibility perspective, that you're thinking of well-being as a factor in engagement. Is that fair for both of you?
Actually, that's very much the case. I think Helene has just absolutely nailed it there when she says that today's workforce, it's not all about pay. Most people actually go to work and we just assume for years pay is the big motivator, but it's all about the non-financial rewards as well. People have forever wanted to go to work to do meaningful work, stuff where you feel appreciated on a daily basis. And that's really important in a day where we're actually now competing for staff, especially when we've got this working from home where we have a generic workforce that can work anywhere. It's the non-financial rewards, this idea of the social impact that we've got with people, that's the winner of the moment that's going to retain our workforce.
I would like to add that for me and what I've witnessed is the people want to be part of something bigger than themselves, and that's where the organisation comes in. They want to represent the causes that are close to them. They want to treat the customers the way they would like to be treated themselves. So it's the ethical concept is not just about the profitability, other things that come into it, and if they're not considered, then people start to disengage and look for other opportunities outside which resonate more with them. And younger people, for them, the organisations and the work that they do blends with their identity. That's how they see themselves in the world. And as future leaders, we need to think very closely as to what sort of world and environment we want to create as a result of the work that we do within the organisations.
Brilliant. So I guess we're starting to build a business case for well-being and for thinking about responsibility in those kind of broad terms that we've talking about. So in terms of why businesses should take this seriously, we've mentioned employee engagement and that feeds through into customer engagement. That was your point, Helena. What other kind of things are kind of significant from a business perspective in making this case?
I think Helena's just again made a really useful point there. Young people now come to expect this as part of their overall package. And if we're not giving people what they expect as part of the package, we're just simply not being competitive in a world where finding staff is hard work at the moment. And I think this is one of the things that we need to do. Because, again, it's this idea that ethics, social responsibility, young people are being bombarded with this and they take it on as part of their life experience, their persona. And this is something we have to give to them, particularly if we're going to retain them in our businesses in a competitive world.
I would also want to add that there has been many issues that came out and been talked about a lot, like mental well-being, inclusion. A lot of people are suffering with depression challenges in their life outside work. And for me, as a leader, I am thinking about how do I give people opportunity throughout within the organization to develop a broader skill sets, because they no longer just need to deal with the business challenges. People also sort of deal with broader aspects of life, which sort of blends with work. And quite often, we just assume that everybody knows how to talk about it, how to deal with it. And often, it's not just about the work, but if something is happening in your personal life and you don't feel supported at work, suddenly it sort of translates into issues at work, which can be avoided if we create environments and give people the right skills and make them feel supported, and the family aspect of the organization starts to come up more and more often. People want to feel that that's their family, that's their tribe, and everybody is looking for that sort of sense of belonging and support outside the direct responsibilities at work. So it's a much bigger concept these days.
No, that absolutely makes sense to me. That, you know, we spend a lot of time in the workplace, the relationships we build and the engagement that we have with colleagues, with customers, with clients, whatever environment we're in, are often kind of very kind of significant and kind of impactful on that kind of day-to-day basis. I was wondering on the back of that, whether either of you thought that, you know, the post-COVID environment had changed that any, or to any extent, thinking about we had, you know, protracted periods of lockdown, you know, very different dynamics in terms of how people were working. And even today, you know, much more evidence of flexible working and people either working only part-time in offices or where they're able to. And that's changed the dynamic of the workplace quite significantly. I don't know whether you've got any experience of that or any insights into terms of, you know, how the new post-COVID normal might be affecting that dynamic you're talking about.
I certainly noticed that during pandemic, many businesses, including ours, we had to revamped our operational model. So suddenly people had to readjust the way they work or the type of work they've been asked to do or the means that they've been asked to use. Certainly for some people, going digital wasn't that easy because it's all non-verbal elements that disappear, and sort of looking at Zoom meetings all day doesn't really inspire many people. Trying to be motivated at 4 o'clock, it becomes very difficult. So it's certainly the way we do work and how do we support people in developing new skills, managing this transition whilst they're experiencing other turbulence in life, such as, you know, the economic backdrop and uncertainty in the war and other things that people are trying to process as experiences. Is that skill set which goes beyond professional development, where every organization was encouraging people to, you know, acquire the technical skills. I think the shift is now on acquiring broader range of experiences because people have to deal with broader range of issues at work, and clients certainly are experiencing different things, and you have to have diverse workforce which can respond to that. But it's something we as leaders have to build and help people to develop, because it's not that easy, and people may be at different stages of their development, and technology is a big element which everybody is battling with.
I think that the current work environment post-COVID has dramatically changed. We've done some research on this over the last couple of months, and one of the single biggest things that has changed is engagement. We often view engagement as engaged the organisation, but actually that's an incorrect way of looking at engagement. The single most powerful question you ask about engagement is engaged to what? And people are often engaged to their team members, the type of work they do, far more than they are to the organisation. And it's that that retains people in the organisation. And one of the big things with COVID, when people have been on furlough or laid off, they often have a change in association from the organisation, which they often feel may have let them down. And their sole contact with the organisation when they've been laid off may be their immediate line manager. And we found that engagement has changed, where the line manager is what people are often engaged to now. And that's really important, because if the line manager is seen to be unfair, unethical in any way, that can impact people. And it goes back to the old adage that people leave managers, people don't leave organizations. So we've had a massive shift in the way people work with COVID.
Definitely. I've certainly long-standing been of the opinion that the relationship you have with your line manager is key to your success in your career. And there's lots of research evidence to back that up. And with the change in the dynamics in the workplace over COVID, I can certainly see how that would have been kind of more significant as well. So we're starting to talk a bit about some of the dynamics around engagement and well-being and the issues kind of affecting those. Helena, you mentioned the economic climate and the economic environment, and I think kind of come back to you, given your background and your business, as it were, around kind of financial planning. So I guess somebody might be surprised, but obviously we know you and know your interests and know your passions, that somebody from a financial planning background is here talking about well-being. But I guess there is a financial aspect to this as well, particularly in the current climate with, you know, the kind of rise of prices and the kind of the squeeze on discretionary incomes and all the challenges that we're facing with, you know, yes, inflation is falling, but, you know, it's still inflating at a higher level than we've had for many, many a year. I wonder whether you had any insights from that sort of financial perspective. What are the factors that firms need to consider in that regard in thinking about engagement and well-being?
I would take even a step back and bring other concepts in a way that in the past people had so-called guaranteed benefits delivered to them through work, and we observed where people would start join the organization and they basically retire with the same employer and they get a guaranteed pension at the end. So they felt protected and there was a clarity as to what to expect and how to plan for your later life. With the more recent changes in the environment where people were given choice and the personal pensions, it shifted the responsibility for people to build provisions for their life and make a lot more decisions. That doesn't necessarily mean that we have given people the skills and the knowledge as to how to make these decisions. And often what we see in small organizations and to some degree large organizations as well, that we put all this, the management puts all these provisions in place, such as the benefit package, including pension contributions, you know, life cover and various other elements. But these things have not been explained to people as to what they mean and how they fit in with their personal planning. And often they, when you start a pension when you're 20 and contributing, I don't know, £100 a month, how does that give you confidence that by the time you're 68, you will have a pot of, you know, sufficient money to provide for your retirement? And often the projections and the material that we give people is so generic that they just feel disengaged, and we have the right intention, but we don't always go above and beyond and trying to see it from the other side, on the receiving side. How does that look? And do your people actually understand and value the benefits that you're giving them? Or is it just a tick box exercise to say, yes, we have a pension? And I think for me, going forward, this is going to distinguish organizations who will take a step beyond that, and they will start to engage with people and educate them and give them that bigger, you know, tool set to actually see how this integrates, how this supports them outside work. Because often, you know, if you're uncertain about your future and you have anxiety about your finance, you're certainly not going to be focused on day-to-day tasks. So that's the biggest sort of change that I'm seeing, and there is more interest from the organizations now to bring this topic into workplaces and through workshops or podcasts or some other media where people can start having those discussions and what that means and how it applies to me personally, as opposed to just having a statement which goes into the bin because nobody understands it.
I think one of the big things that's often missed in terms of financial difficulties is the impact it has on the managers themselves. Because one of the things that we forget is that managers are people as well. Now, one of the downsides of the stress in managers is that managers often lose, some people say they've got no empathy, but managers actually tend to reduce the amount of empathy because they're so busy fixating on the problems of the organization, their own problems, that we don't have that extra little bit of time for our staff. And when we lose our extra time for our staff, that empathy of people saying thank you, appreciation on the rest of the stuff, particularly this has a disproportionate effect on engaged staff, because in round figures, we assume that everybody's engaged or disengaged. That's not actually the case. Roughly 10% of people are engaged, 10% of people are not engaged or disengaged, and around about 80% just want to come to work, do the bit and go home. But if we look at the engaged people, they're the people who go for the validation, the reward, the expectance, the recognition, appreciation of going the extra mile. And if we as managers tend not to give them that recognition, we often find that our engagement at the top end of the workforce tends to fade away. And one of the sort of great unknowns of engagement is that the people who are disengaged, they were usually the people that were highly engaged and feel as though they were no longer valued or not rewarded, non-financially rewarded, with praise and recognition for the extra work. And that can have a massive impact on our performance, because the engaged people are the people who've got the foot on the accelerator, and the disengaged are the people who've got the foot on the brake. And when we're too busy trying to solve our financial problems, we can have that disproportionate shift in engagement.
I'm just cutting into the podcast to tell you a little bit about the offer that we have for businesses locally as part of the business and community engagement support. We have our Knowledge Transfer Network, that's regular networking events where you can come on campus, meet like-minded people, hear from some of our and leading industry experts. We have our Bradford Business Challenge projects, where we have students coming out and working with you and supporting the work that you do. We have our consultancy clinic, where we have students delivering on short-term small projects for businesses as well. There's also lots of ways that you can engage with and interact with our students as guest lecturers, as mentors on some of our entrepreneurship programs, and through involvement in the curriculum. And equally, from a research perspective, we can work with you on collaborative research. If you think there's something we can help with, please reach out to us at BACE, that's base, BACE, at bradford.ac.uk. Thank you, and now back to the podcast. So there's something about how we support managers and recognise the challenges of being in a management role in a challenging environment. That's a perennial that doesn't go away. But I think there's another fundamental point that you started with, Helen, about, I hesitate to use a phrase, but I can't think of a better one, financial literacy or just financial awareness. I mean, I was chuckling as you were talking, because talking to our final year undergraduate students about rewards that are offered by organisations and asking them that question, and they'll talk about pay, they'll talk about bonuses, they'll talk about company cars, very rare things this day and age, but they're all in their heads, all those sorts of things. They almost never mention a pension. And it's almost, you know, it's seen as almost as a cost when you raise it with students. It's, you know, why am I paying for a pension in my 20s when I, you know, I'm not going to get that money till I'm in my 60s, and actually I don't even know if I'm going to get that money, you know, because there's been all the issues with pension mis-selling and pension valuation in kind of recent history. So I think there is something about how we shift a mindset around lifetime financing as part of these things. And yes, it's an incredibly difficult economic environment, but if you can convince, I certainly wish I'd started a pension in my early 20s, I'd be much better for planned retirement in however many years before I get there than I would be now. It's about making that an interesting topic at that age and kind of engaging people. I don't know that we've necessarily found an answer to that yet.
Having delivered financial well-being workshops, what I find is, as part of that, they don't necessarily have to be product specific, but if you show people concept and being in a group and that inertia in finance, particularly for younger people, you commit and you do it because there are other people around you doing it, that often leads to that sort of initial move, because once you in or you started or mentally committed to something, and if other people around you are doing it, you sort of, is less chances you're going to opt out or decide, or I'm going to leave until next year to make a decision. And having sort of opportunity to engage and have somebody in a room with expertise, he and perhaps ask, you know, what is looks like for your older clients, and because we connect through stories, and yes, we can put all the information online and say you should be able to work it out. That's not how human beings engage, and often just sharing simple stories from other clients or drawing on experiences that happen to other people makes it resonates. It's immense to see the change that it sort of leads to in people over the years, because a lot of wealthy individuals who we now service as a business, they also started small. They also went through their own uncertainties in life. But quite often is that someone has motivated them or encouraged them, and they made that commitment very early in life, and they now can see the results of it. And what we're seeing with younger people is a lot of more, the social media, everything is gloomy, and it's a lot harder for people to make decisions, particularly around concepts that they never understood, they've never been explained, it doesn't form part of your curriculum. We teach them all the technical skills that they need to do the job, but we don't teach necessarily the life skills. We just assume that they have to work it out, and people will make mistakes. And as part of the organization, we have the capacity to bring these topics and open the conversation so that people are equipped and they know when they need to seek advice. And certainly the robot advice and many of automated services have failed because they don't have that human element. And also for employees, it creates that sense that they cared and supported all around as individuals, as opposed to, well, I'll just give you this skill set to do the job, and because I can profit from you, is that sense of belonging and openness in organizations to tackle challenging aspects. Because yes, not always you can give people just the pay rise, and the pay rise often doesn't solve the problems, because if the money is mismanaged and they don't know how to budget or how to best use it, they're still left with the shortfall, and the next year you face the same problem.
So I think we're starting to build something of the business case and best practice for thinking about how we manage people's well-being and how that kind of creates with engagement. And I think the point about having the stories, the examples, the illustrations that bring these things to life. Yeah, a dry pension document that, you know, with a calculator that, you know, tells you what it might be worth in an indeterminate number of years' time doesn't really tell you a story, but the story of an individual who's invested and this is the value that they've created from that kind of definitely does. Come back to you, George. You know, from building that best practice in terms of well-being, what are the other things that you might consider important for firms?
I think the simple best advice you can give to managers is know your staff. And this idea of well-being, engagement, or even motivation. There's a golden rule in life. If you know what motivates your staff, you've got control over the way they move. And that comes down to basic old-fashioned communication, and what we might say old-fashioned good management. Know your staff, talk to them, find out their little problems. My USP in life is knowing what people's little niggles in life are and taking them away. That's my special superpower, if you will, being able to listen to people enough to take their minor niggles away. And you can move mountains with people who will follow you for that reason.
So it's about understanding people, being able to respond to them and their needs, and actually helping them in such a way that it enables them to focus, I guess, and do the job better.
You've just nailed it there, Dave. Just focusing. They have a little thing that's on their mind, distracting them from what they're supposed to be doing, and you can fix that little something for them. And there's this idea of social exchange. I've just looked after you. You look after me. My goals are my key performance indicators, whatever. I've just solved your problems. Now you help me solve mine. It's not rocket science. It's good old-fashioned management.
I would also build on that. I think if you treat your employees as business partners rather than just employees, it also creates the empowerment that they feel heard and that their contribution matters, and allowing people to express themselves and sort of participate in shaping the business. Because if it's only a top-down decision, we go in this direction and the whole workforce is screaming saying that's not the right way, I think that's quite dangerous, and we have to start developing that more, because collectively within the organization probably have all the skill sets and knowledge that we need to take the business forward. It's just how do we encourage people to participate, and leading by example and showing them that if they do contribute, they'll be heard, and you know that their voice will be considered, as opposed to, yeah, we just create a platform, you can say things, but we'll still do it our way. So it's that collective decision making, I think, also enriches and makes us more resilient.
And I think the Helena's just nailed another good point there. One of the big things is we tend to listen to people enough to give them what we think they want. And it's this idea of when we talk about communication, listening to people, you know, it's truly listening to them. It's truly finding out what they want, not listening enough to look on our shelf of tools that we can take off, the preset tools to give them. But sometimes that involves a little bit of extra work to sort of give people what they want, to include them in the package. And it's that, for me, is what we should be doing, giving people what they need and want to move forward. That'll then truly empower them that way.
Brilliant. So to actually come back to an interest of mine, you know, the advantage of being host is you're you're allowed to bring in your own interests. But something you mentioned, Hannah, as well, and I'm thinking particularly about the dynamics of how the size of a firm affects this. So a lot of this sort of understanding your employees, being close to them, you know, you mentioned family as Hannah as well, are all things that might feel or seem easier for a smaller firm. I wondered about what you both thought about the dynamics of this. Is it easier to do in that small to medium-sized enterprise, or are those challenges of engagement different or harder for a bigger business or a bigger organization?
I think in a large organization, it translates in you're breaking it down to the teams, because effectively each manager or each individual has its limits in terms of how many hours in a day you have and how much can you dedicate to truly connecting to people and following through and recognizing little things and noticing it. So you have to define your line of influence, and it might be multiple people creating that, and then you just have to have an overall sort of theme as to what you would like to create as a large organization. Because even for a smaller firm, you might have people working in different locations and you know always in touch with them in the same way, and it's a big challenge. And not to be afraid that as a leader there might be other people who are doing the work on your behalf, and it might be a team leader, or we call them champions in the team, so it could be any person. And sometimes you have to recognize if you are not the people's person and someone else is better at that, you can work with that person to link and create bridges within the organization.
The literature generally says something along the lines that smaller firms typically have higher levels of engagement than larger firms, and it's almost like a linear. The bigger you are, the less engagement you have. And that goes back to this idea of you tend to be further from the source of empowerment. If I'm in a small firm of half a dozen people, I tend to see the boss on a daily basis and my views tend to count more. There's no reason that larger firms can't tap into this stuff, because one of the big things that we look at leadership is we tend to see leadership as this guy at the top with the white flag that says, follow me, guys. But the truth of the matter is that organizations are full of leaders, down to these informal people who sort of lead their teams, their shifts on a daily basis. Understanding that we can utilize these people to drive our people forward by knowing who our informal leaders are, and we can use them in terms of moving our people along with engagement. And I think that big firms tend not to get that when they become hierarchical. Use your leaders to engage your people. Remember that people are engaged to something. More often, it's to your team and your immediate line manager. Once we understand that, we have a very powerful tool for motivating our people to achieve our goals.
Brilliant. Thank you both. I'm conscious we've had a wide-ranging conversation that started off talking about well-being. We've gone through engagement and through financial well-being and kind of back again. If there was one sort of piece of practical advice you would offer for anybody listening to this in terms of the themes that we've talked about, what's the one thing you would recommend that they should do on the back of our conversation? What would that be? Hannah, I'll come to you first.
I think for me, trusting your people and giving them the right information, empowering them to make change on the ground, and not being afraid to change the direction or change the decision if the sort of feedback from the team is that perhaps that wasn't a good move. I think this goes to the core of responsible management, is that link between you and the people, and collectively working out which way to go, because ultimately people are at the center of it, and each one of them is unique, and utilizing that and drawing on their experiences will bring the greater benefit to the organization.
And I think that theme of the link to your organization and your people is all important. One of the big things we do as managers, we develop this, we go to our business schools, we learn about these management styles, we learn how to deal with our people, and then we employ that same modus operandi over many years. But the truth of the matter is our workforce changes. Even the people we've known a long time change. Think of it as working with your own family and your kids. When the kids are small, you think you know them. By the time they're teenagers, my daughter once said to me, Dad, you know nothing about how young women think, and yet you think you understand your own kids. It's a dynamic environment that we're working in, and employing the same technique that worked yesterday for tomorrow, it just isn't the way to cut it. We need to constantly adjust our way of working with our people and know that our people change over time as well.
Brilliant. Thank you both. One final question, slightly different, but we're asking this of all of our contributors over the series. So who's your management hero, personal or professional, that person who's inspired or influenced you the most in your career?
I will relate to Sam Walton from Walmart. Having read the books about his style, it resonates with me because it brings the empowerment, the trust in people, the family feel. And yes, it's a much bigger organization than mine, but I think we can draw on many, many things that people done before us successfully and bring those elements back into our organizations to take every business that we come across forward, and certainly how you treat your partners in business, because we are part of an ecosystem and it's every party who's important, and making that positive change in your area of work is very, very important to me.
My hero is a guy called John O'Neill. John O'Neill is my very first boss. When I very first went to work, you might not believe this, but it was a brash young man who thought he was going to rule the world. And this guy basically took me under his wing. And after 3 months, I'm running around for this guy. And I asked him one day, John, what have I done to upset you? Because I'm doing three times as much work as everybody else. And he said to me, you're a Ferrari. And if I don't keep you revved hard, you're going to be a pain in the butt. Now get out there and carry on working. And after 3 years, he called me into his office and he said to me, you need to leave. I said, John, I'm your best worker. I work every day for you super hard. He said, but I've taken you as far as I can. Now, go into this big bad world and do your best out there, because it's time to move on. That was 30 years ago. And to this day, I still try to emulate that man. And what I didn't know at the time is that he was dying of Parkinson's, and he took time to care about his people enough to develop them at the cost of it. So 30 years down the line, still John O'Neill.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, both. Thank you for those insights and all the insights that we've had throughout the session. It's been really interesting, a really stimulating discussion. If people want to reach out to you, is there a way they can contact you, Helena?
Yes, so it's Helena@ebofinancial.co.uk. So happy to take any follow-up questions or inquiries about the workshops or employee engagement in the financial aspect. We can also, all the contact details are on the website, so can be reached that way.
Yeah, it's the Bradford University website, and it's g.madine, which is M-A-D-I-N-E, then the number one, @bradford.ac.uk.
Thank you both. Thank you. So if you want to reach out to us more generally, you can find the business and community pages of the School of Management on the university website. My social media handle is @DavePSpicer. If you want to follow the School of Management, it's @BradManagement, B-R-A-D Management. And if you want to email us at the Business and Community Engagement Team at the School of Management, it's BACE@bradford.ac.uk. Thank you very much again, both, for your contributions. We hope you've enjoyed this session, and we'll be back again. Thank you. If you've got a project that you'd love to get done, but you're struggling with the time and resources to do that, that's something that we can help you with. Bradford Business Challenge projects are where we get our students to do, as part of their dissertation, a piece of applied management work for a business like yourself. Either one of our final year undergraduate or MSc students, with the support of an academic mentor, will be able to work on that project for you. There's no cost for you as a business. All we ask for you is to set up with us that project, give us a kind of outline brief that the student will go away and work into a full proposal for you, and then you'll be meeting and liaising with them and their academic advisor to get that project delivered. Because we have multiple students doing these over the course of the year, there's usually a group of students looking for any project at one time. So if that's something that you're interested in and you'd like to know more about, please reach out to us at BACE, base@bradford.ac.uk.